Verehrte Damen und Herren, Eure Seligkeit, Eminenzen, Exzellenzen, es ist ein ganz besonderer Tag heute. Es ist für die katholische Kirche, auch die griechisch-katholische Kirche, das Fest des heiligen Josaphat. Es ist heute eine besondere Fügung, dass seine Seligkeit, Großerzbischof von Kiew, der griechisch-katholischen Kirche in unserer Mitte ist. Ich darf ihn herzlich begrüßen und ihm danken, dass er sich die Zeit genommen hat, nach Wien zu kommen. Wien und Lemberg, wo er früher tätig war, sind durch tiefe historische Bande verbunden. Ich darf in besonderer Weise unseren Gemeinderabbiner Schlomo Hofmeister begrüßen, der die Kontinuität repräsentiert in dieser Initiative von Kardinal Initzer, zu der, an der der damalige Oberrabbiner von Wien teilgenommen hat, in dieser Solidaritätsaktion für die Hungernden in der Sowjetunion und speziell in der Ukraine. Ich darf den Vertreter des ökumenischen Patriarchen, unseren Metropoliten Arsenius, herzlich begrüßen, den Bischof Andrei von der serbisch-orthodoxen Kirche, den Bischof der armenischen Kirche, neugeweihten Bischof Petrosian und alle Geistlichen, die zu diesem Anlass gekommen sind. Ich sehe auch den Superintendenten der lutherisch-evangelischen Kirche, den ich herzlich begrüßen darf. Ich begrüße ganz herzlich den Botschafter der Ukraine hier bei uns in Österreich, der uns nachher auch die Grußworte sagen wird. Und Sie werden verstehen, dass ich Dr. Johannes Initzer und seine Frau besonders begrüße. Er ist ein Großneffe von Kardinal Initzer. Ich freue mich, dass er unter uns ist. Ich darf Sie alle herzlich begrüßen, ganz besonders auch die Vertreter der anderen Länder, den deutschen Botschafter. Freue mich, dass er neu bei uns in Österreich als Botschafter ist, und auch den Präsidenten von Pro Oriente mit seiner Gattin. Und natürlich Professor Timothy Snyder, der vielleicht selber uns sagen wird, wie symbolkräftig auch diese Tage für ihn sind. Er war gestern in Prag. Heute vor 30 Jahren hat die Heiligsprechung der Agnes von Böhmen in Rom stattgefunden. Und zum ersten Mal hat die kommunistische Regierung 10.000 Pilgern erlaubt, zu diesem Ereignis nach Rom zu fahren. 5 Tage später, am 17. November 1989, hat die Samtene Revolution in Tschechien, in der Tschechoslowakei, in Prag begonnen. Das Gedenken heute und die Enthüllung der Gedenktafel erinnert an eine der schrecklichsten Seiten der Geschichte, der vielen schrecklichen Seiten des 20. Jahrhunderts. Der großteils gezielt und gewollt durchgeführte Mord, so kann man es nur nennen, an unschuldigen Menschen, deren einziges Vergehen war, dass sie Landwirtschaft betrieben. Wir werden über dieses Drama heute noch ausführlicher hören. Es gilt aber heute auch, mit diesem Gedenken die Erinnerung an einen Mann hochzuhalten, dessen Name oft sehr einseitig nur mit einem Akt verbunden wird, den er selber zutiefst bereut hat, im März 1938. Kardinal Theodor Innitzer, mein Vorgänger. Dass Kardinal Innitzer ein mutiger und weitsichtiger Mann war, das wird der heutige Gedenktag wieder bewusst machen. Und ich danke Professor Timothy Snyder, dass er die Mühe auf sich genommen hat, aus diesem Anlass hier zu sein und uns über dieses Ereignis genaueres zu berichten. Es war eine ökumenische Initiative, es war eine interreligiöse Initiative, die Plattform, die Kardinal Innitzer zusammen mit dem Oberrabbiner und mit anderen geschaffen hat, war rein humanitär, keine politischen Absichten. Es ging darum, die Welt aufmerksam zu machen, die freie Welt aufmerksam zu machen, was sich in der Sowjetunion und speziell in der Sowjetukraine abspielt an humanitärer Katastrophe. Ich darf auch daran erinnern, dass es dieser Kardinal Innitzer war, der 1938, einen Monat vor der Reichspogromnacht, von der Hitlerjugend um ein Haar aus dem Fenster geworfen worden wäre. Er konnte flüchten und sich verstecken, aber die Hitlerjugend hat das erzbischöfliche Palais verwüstet, aus Rache für das, was Kardinal Innitzer am Vortag vor 7000 Jugendlichen im Dom gesagt hatte. Sie ermutigt hat, im Glauben treu zu bleiben, nicht dem Nationalsozialismus nachzugeben. Das war natürlich einverstanden, einbegriffen in diesen Worten. Und als er dann sagte, Jesus Christus ist unser Führer, wurde das als unerträgliche Provokation verstanden, die die Racheaktion des nächsten Tages ausgelöst hat. Einige Tage später wurde in einer Massendemonstration auf dem Heldenplatz der Tod Innitzers gefordert und auf den Spruchbändern war zu lesen, Innitzer und Jud eine Brut. Die Initiative von Kardinal Innitzer, die Welt aufmerksam zu machen auf die Hungerkatastrophe in der Sowjetunion, gehört sicher zu den mutigen Seiten der blutigen Geschichte des 20. Jahrhunderts. Danke, dass Sie gekommen sind. Danke, dass Sie an diesem Gedenken teilnehmen.
Ich darf Sei die Seligkeit Großerzbischof Swjatoslaw Schewtschuk bitten um seine Grußworte. Er ist das Oberhaupt der ukrainischen griechisch-katholischen Kirche. Er ist Großerzbischof von Kiew-Halitsch.
Your Eminence, Your Excellencies, distinguished representatives of the Protestant, Jewish and Armenian communities, distinguished ambassadors and representatives of the diplomatic corps, ladies and gentlemen. The Holodomor, the artificial famine genocide in Ukraine in 1932-1933, is still an open wound in the memory, as well as in the body and soul, of Ukrainians around the world. The crime that happened in Ukraine at that time was planned explicitly against Ukrainian farmers and the people who worked on Europe's richest soil, called the breadbasket of Europe, organized by confiscating every kind of food and isolating the region with the military units, it became the most efficient and cheapest weapon of mass destruction, killing everyone present in that territory. Ukrainians, Jews, Germans, and everyone who disagreed with the policy of Stalin. When this disaster erupted, Metropolitan Andrei Sheptytsky, with his bishops in western Ukraine, which at that time was a part of the restored Polish state, began receiving alarming news from eyewitnesses every day from the Soviet part of Ukraine. At that time, the church was the only voice that could be raised on behalf of the innocent, voiceless, and helpless victims. Immediately, Metropolitan Andrei was trying to inform Europeans about the atrocity of those crimes, which killed more than 8 million Ukrainians. Even today, we do not know the exact number of those victims. He made an appeal on July 24th, 1933, on behalf of the Ukrainian Catholic bishops, called Ukraina v peredsmertnych sudorogach, Ukraine in the death throes, and organized an international campaign to save fellow human beings dying of hunger. The first to echo the appeal of Metropolitan Andrei Sheptytsky was Cardinal Theodor Innitzer of Vienna. On August 20th, 1933, by writing his own appeal to the whole world, he was the first and the only one among the Catholic European leaders to organize an international and interreligious committee together with the Orthodox, Protestant, Armenian, and Jewish communities to awaken the consciousness of public opinion to gather humanitarian aid and widely inform the world of the famine taking place in Ukraine, which the Soviet state vehemently denied on every level and at every occasion across the globe. Today, it is a great privilege for me here in Vienna to be the voice of the voiceless victims of Holodomor. And together with His Eminence, Cardinal Christoph Schönborn, Cardinal Innitzer's successor, my brother bishops of the Orthodox churches, and our Protestant brothers and sisters, along with the chief rabbi of Vienna, and the Jewish and Armenian communities in Austria, to remember and honor their memory here. As long as crime is silenced, it continues to kill. For this reason, today's event truly has a therapeutic and healing significance for us Ukrainians. We remember the tragedies of the Ukrainian Holodomor genocide in order that similar crimes never happen again. The moment we forget about them or silence the voice of our brothers, whose voice is calling out to heaven from the ground, the criminal ideologies and events have the chance of being repeated. We remember in order to prevent this from ever happening again. By inaugurating this memorial plaque dedicated to Cardinal Theodor Innitzer here in Vienna, in the name of the Ukrainian people, I would like to express our thanks to him for his heroic acts which he did during his lifetime. I would like to thank His Eminence Christoph Schönborn, who wished to have this plaque placed in his Archiepiscopal Palace, a place which remembers the anger and violence of the Nazis towards Cardinal Initzer. Thank you, Your Eminence, that you care for the wounds and pains of the Ukrainian people today. And thank you to all of you who, by your presence, express your solidarity with the Ukrainian people today. May the merciful God reward you with his infinite mercy. Thank you.
Vielen Dank, dass Sie so weit hergekommen sind, um uns dieses Wort zu sagen, auch dieses Wort der Anerkennung für Kardinal Initzer. Und mit großer Dankbarkeit darf ich nun auch das Wort für Grußworte übergeben an den Herrn Oberlandesrabbiner Magister Shlomo Hofmeister.
Exzellenzen, Eminenzen, Herr Erzbischof, wir alle kennen die Geschichte von Noach vor der Sintflut. Die Tora, die Bibel, nennt Noach einen Gerechten, ein Gerechter in seiner Generation. Eine berühmte Meinungsverschiedenheit im Talmud diskutiert die Frage, was bedeutet dieses Wort in seiner Generation? Bedeutet es, er war ein Gerechter? Trotz seiner Generation, trotz der Verkommenheit seiner Generation, hat er es geschafft, gerecht zu bleiben, sich nicht durch den Einfluss seiner Umwelt hinunterziehen zu lassen? Oder war ein Gerechter nur in seiner Generation? Im Vergleich zu seiner Generation war ein Gerechter. Hätte er gelebt in der Zeit von Abraham, wäre er kein besonders Gerechter gewesen. Noach, so sagt der Prophet Jeschkel, tritt aus der Arche heraus, der Midrasch führt es weiter aus, die mündliche Lehre, und weint über die zerstörte Welt. Und er fleht Gott an, warum hast du diese Welt zerstört? Und Gott antwortet ihm, jetzt weinst du? Ich habe dir gesagt, die Arche zu bauen, die Tiere zu retten. Ich habe dir gesagt, die Menschheit ist verkommen, ich werde die Menschheit zerstören. Du hast nichts getan. Du hast dich um deine Familie gekümmert, um deine Arche, dein Schiff, damit du dich und deine Lieben rettest und deine Mitmenschen. Der Midrasch sagt, Gott sprach, es werde Licht. Das ist Abraham. Was ist der Unterschied zwischen Abraham und Noach? Noach, derjenige, ein Zadik, ein Gerechter in seiner Generation, der sich um seine Familie kümmerte, den Auftrag Gottes erfüllte, aber um seine eigenen Schäfchen ins Trockene zu bringen, sich nicht um seine Mitmenschen kümmerte. Abraham, der auf Kosten seiner eigenen Familie, auf Kosten seiner familiären Abstammung, auf Kosten seines eigenen Interesses sich für die Menschheit einsetzte, wird das Licht genannt in einer dunklen Welt. Unsere Weisen lernen in den Sprüchen der Väter, wer sagt, meines gehört mir und deines gehört dir, das ist der Charakter von Sodom. Was auch immer wir assoziieren mit Sodom und Gomorra, schreckliche Verbrechen, Verkommenheit der Menschheit, schreckliche Moral und ethische Zustände, und unsere Weisen lernen, was mir gehört mir, was dir gehört dir. Wir leben auch in einer Zeit heutzutage, in dem das Recht des Individuums, der Besitz des Individuums, soziale Gerechtigkeit nicht unbedingt an erster Stelle stehen, sondern die Frage dessen, was steht mir zu, was gehört mir. Abraham hat ein Zeichen gesetzt. Abraham steht für denjenigen, der die Mauern durchbricht. Wohltätigkeit, wir sagen Chesed, Wohltätigkeit anderen gegenüber, Menschen gegenüber, über das nötige Maß hinaus, über das hinaus, was man erwarten könnte, weil man es aus Sympathie, aus Liebe, aus Zuneigung den anderen gegenüber tut, sondern aus der Überzeugung heraus, dass jeder von uns eine Verantwortung hat, einen finanziellen, sozialen, gerechten, solidarischen Ausgleich zu schaffen. Anzuerkennen, wenn es andere Menschen gibt, denen es schlechter geht. Was war die Sünde von Sodom? Erklärte Prophet Jeschkel, sie haben im Überfluss gelebt, aber sie haben sich nicht um die Armen gekümmert. Sie haben nicht von ihrem Überfluss abgegeben, um zu verhindern, dass andere Menschen leiden. Über die eigenen Grenzen hinweg, über die familiären Grenzen hinweg, über die Grenzen der eigenen Volksgemeinschaft, der eigenen Zugehörigkeit, der eigenen Religion hinweg, anderen zu helfen, solidarisch als Mensch einzustehen für andere Menschen, das ist Abraham. Das ist unser gemeinsamer spiritueller Vorvater, der Gründer der Wertesysteme des ethischen Monotheismus, den wir, die wir hier sitzen, alle unterschreiben. Es ist mir ein großes Bedürfnis, dem Erzbischof von Wien, Kardinal Schönborn, und ich nehme mir heraus, hier in einer Jedid Nefesh einen Freund zu nennen, diese Initiative unterstützt, geschaffen zu haben, in Erinnerung zu rufen, diese wunderbare Kooperation der Religionsgesellschaften in einer Zeit, in der das Wort interreligiöser Dialog, geschweige denn Zusammenarbeit, ein Fremdwort war. In einer Zeit, in der die Gesellschaft nicht im Überfluss lebt, in einer Zeit, in der jede Gesellschaft in Europa vor sozialen Herausforderungen stand, in der, wie wir es leider auch kennen wieder in letzter Zeit, soziale Dividierungen, Polarisierungen zur Tagesordnung gehörten. Und in dieser Zeit hat Kardinal Inica ein Zeichen gesetzt und ich möchte sagen, in diesem Zusammenhang betrachte ich unseren Kardinal, den Erzbischof von Wien, nicht nur als einen amtlichen Nachfolger, sondern auch einen Nachfolger im Geiste dieses Kardinals. Es ist mir eine besondere Freude, auch zu sehen, die Eminenzen, die Exzellenzen, auch aus dem Ausland angereist, zu diesem besonderen Akt, zu diesem besonderen Event, was ich hoffe, ein Zeichen setzen kann, dieses in Erinnerung zu rufen, dass wir als Religionsgemeinschaften auch in Zukunft Herausforderungen nicht fürchten dürfen. Wir dürfen nicht uns vor der Politik fürchten, wir dürfen uns nicht vor Populismus fürchten, nicht vor gesellschaftlichen Strömungen, wie es im 19. Jahrhundert die Philosophen mit Furcht nannten, den Zeitgeist, der doch so oft gegen unsere Prinzipien, gegen unsere moralischen Werte widerstößt. Wir alle wissen, die Theorie und die Praxis, auch in unseren eigenen Reihen, ist nicht immer die gleiche. Aber es ist unsere Verantwortung als Vertreter von Religionsgesellschaften, und ich nehme hier alle Religionsgesellschaften mit in das gleiche Boot, es ist unsere Verantwortung, diese Diskrepanz der Theorie und der Praxis zwischen dem, was wir an Werten lehren und lernen, und dem, was dann doch in der Praxis oft geschieht, diese Diskrepanz so klein wie möglich zu halten und auch den Finger darauf zu deuten, wenn es so ist. Ein Zeichen zu setzen, wie es die Religionsvertreter vor 85 Jahren getan haben, ist eine Revolution zur damaligen Zeit. Es war mutig. Heutzutage erfordert es keinen Mut. Aber es erfordert das Verständnis und die Durchsetzungskraft, oft auch mal gegen die eigenen Interessen, dem nachzuahmen, dieses nachzuahmen und das Gleiche zu tun. Ich bedanke mich recht herzlich bei der Erzdiözese, bei allen Anwesenden für das Interesse und noch einmal bei unserem Kardinal für diese Initiative, diese heroische Tat in der damaligen Zeit in Erinnerung zu rufen und durch diese Gedenktafel auch in Erinnerung zu behalten. Vielen Dank.
Vielen Dank auch, dass Sie und mit Ihnen die jüdische Gemeinde diesen Tag, dieses Gedenken mit uns hier begeht. Und als letzte Grußbotschaft vor dem Vortrag von Professor Snyder darf ich nun seine Exzellenz Botschafter Dr. Alexander Scherber, den Botschafter der Ukraine in Österreich, um ein Wort bitten.
Ihre Eminenz, Vaše Blaženstvo. I'll probably speak in English because that's the language everybody understands. Sorry if it's not the case. I hope it is the case. Dear representatives of the clergy, dear Ambassador Beste, and of course, dear Professor Snyder, I won't speak long, and I will speak not only as ambassador, but mostly, and my dear French colleague too. I will speak also on behalf of my family, of the village where my parents come from, of the region where my family comes from, that's Вінниця область, Жмеренка район, Слобода Межирівська, by the way, a place with a big proportion of Jewish population. Thank you, Your Eminence, for conducting this event in the memory of those martyrs who were innocently dying 86, 87 years ago in this terrible winter and spring, and in the memory of those who didn't remain silent in the face of this terrible crime and terrible tragedy. We live in a time of internet where everything can be Googled up, and every small Ukrainian village has an entry on Wikipedia. If you look up the village where my mother comes from on Wikipedia, you will see a stunning number, 20 people casualty of the World War II, 200 people casualty of the Holodomor. It's a small village, but it was hit hard. The family of my grandmother was back then 9 years old. She had a big sister, Marina. She was 12, and small sister, Antonina, she was 3. And they were comparatively lucky. They survived the terrible winter when all of a sudden everybody took away the food on the most fruitful land in the world. People stayed without food for winter and spring, and there was no way to escape from those villages. The villages became the jails, the prisons for those people. And they were comparatively lucky because they survived the winter. But then when the spring came, the trees started blossoming. Marina, the big sister, saw the blossom and ran to the tree and started eating the acacia blossom. It turns out when you are 12, when you are a child, when you didn't eat much, it's poison. So she, as my family was telling over the years, she died in big pain. I just try, my daughter is 12. I try to imagine what kind of despair it was for a child to see the first blossom of a tree. And the first thought that went through her head was food, eat. And multiply this by millions. This is what was happening in the villages throughout central Ukraine, southern Ukraine, eastern Ukraine. Another thing that stuck with my memory for forever. My family wasn't very distinguished. We were an average family in the Soviet Union. We had a relative from the same village who was a director of a plant. And I once, in presence of my grandmother, Olena, said, he's the lucky one. He is the successful one. I wish we were like him. And she paused, and then she said, never say these words again. The only reason why this man is alive is because their child died early enough. And they were eating it during the winter. So, two questions arise from this whole story. How does God allows this, such things to happen? And why were people looking away? Even in these pictures that you were seeing, there were the people dying, the people walking, passing by. The people dying were from the village. The people passing by were from the city. The city was doing rather well. And people who you saw dying, that was the people who broke out of those villages. Even Ukrainians, some Ukrainians were looking away. The world was looking away. That's the second question. I don't know the answer to the first question, why God allows such things to happen. Maybe you, dear fathers of church, will give me the answer to that. But the part to the second question, this event and this plague that we'll be unveiling today will give a part to this answer. Not everybody was silent. Not everybody was looking away. And for me, it's one more reason to believe in God, to believe in humankind. And I thank you for that.
Vielen Dank, Herr Botschafter, indem Sie uns sozusagen erlaubt haben, etwas von Ihrer Familiengeschichte zu hören, haben Sie den Holodomor hier von einem historischen Ereignis in eine Realität geholt, die uns, glaube ich, in Ihren Worten sehr nahe gekommen ist. Und eine gute Vorbereitung ist für das, was uns Professor Timothy Snyder nun über den historischen Kontext von Inizias Initiative und dem Holodomor sagen wird. Professor Snyder, nur ein ganz wenige Anmerkungen zu seiner Person, ist Professor für Geschichte auf der Universität von Yale und seit vielen Jahren auch Fellow am Institut für die Wissenschaft vom Menschen in Wien und ist Experte für osteuropäische Geschichte und hat sein wohl bekanntestes Buch ist Bloodlands, die Geschichte sozusagen eines großen Teiles von Osteuropa, das im 20. Jahrhundert in ganz besonders tragischer Weise heimgesucht worden ist von massenmörderischen Initiativen, Aktivitäten. Dieses Buch Bloodlands ist, glaube ich, in an die 30 Sprachen übersetzt, auch auf Deutsch, ist trotz seines wirklich schwer zu konsumierenden Inhaltes, ich sage das so vorsichtig, ein Bestseller geworden. Und Professor Snyder, dafür sind wir sehr dankbar, hat wie Juri Kolassa, der hier diese Veranstaltung mit seiner Aktivität vorangetrieben hat, ihn gefragt hat, ob er hier den Festvortrag halten würde, sofort zugesagt, wofür wir ganz besonders dankbar sind. Damit möchte ich Ihnen auch schon hier das Feld überlassen. Auch Professor Snyder wird in Englisch zu uns sprechen. Ich glaube, er könnte es wahrscheinlich sogar auf Deutsch, er könnte es wahrscheinlich auch auf Französisch und wahrscheinlich in einigen osteuropäischen Sprachen. Aber wir haben uns mit ihm auf Englisch verständigt. Falls Sie Schwierigkeiten haben, den Ausführungen zu folgen, Juri Kolassa hat versprochen, dass es eine Übersetzung geben wird in entsprechender Frist. Dann müssen Sie bis dahin warten, um nachzuholen, sozusagen alle Feinheiten aus seinem Vortrag. Professor Snyder, herzlichen Dank. The floor is yours.
So, Your Eminences, Learned Rabbi, Excellencies, thank you very much for this opportunity. For a historian, nothing could be more touching than to see the memories, dark though they may be, of the past, joined with the effort to remember, strenuous as it may be, in the present, in the hope that what we do remember and strain to remember may have a consequence for the future. So it is my great pleasure to be among you, and I thank you for this opportunity to bring what light my own profession, that of a historian, can to these dark events. What I would like to share with you in the next half hour or so is a sense of what happened in those years, 1932 to 1933, to share with you a sense of what was known, which really means why so little was known at the time, to speak for a moment about just what it was that Archbishop Initza and other men of the church did in 1932 and 1933, why it was extraordinary, and then to say a few words about just what this might signify today. So it is a difficult task after hearing from my Ukrainian friends about their recollections, general and personal, of the events of 1932 and 1933, to speak to you about them in a general historical way. And yet, I think it is very important that we do so, for each murder, each death is part of a larger story, irreducible as it is, unforgettable as it is, it's also part of a set of events which ought to be remembered and understood on their own, not least because they can remind us, at least in some of their outlines, of certain kinds of things that have happened since, or, God forbid, might happen yet in the future. Archbishop Schönborn was kind enough to recall that this is an anniversary year of another kind. This is an anniversary of the end of communism in Europe. As the Archbishop was kind enough to mention, I've spent the last few days going from European capital to European capital, thinking about what it means that communism has come to an end. In this somber setting, I'm reminded that we can't know what an ending means unless we've fully understood the event itself. It's very easy to celebrate 1989 or 1991. It's very easy to congratulate ourselves on what we think we might have done to bring these good events about. But to understand what it means for communism to have come to an end, we also have to have our minds and our spirits around the essence of what that system was. I think there's a very good case to be made that the events at which we have hinted here, the events of 1932 to 1933, are the darkest moment in that history. Certainly a central one, certainly one that tells us a good deal about the history of that system, and therefore one which we must try to remember in general as well as in particular. So let me make an essay in that direction. What we're remembering today are events that took place inside the Soviet Union, events that took place inside the Soviet Republic called Ukraine. What we're remembering today are a set of events that unfold between mainly 1932 and 1933, but which are part of a larger project in the Soviet Union of building a certain kind of state. The Soviet Union, when it was established, faced two basic kinds of challenges, and it was the attempt to overcome these challenges, these problems, which led to the decisions in 1932 and 1933, which brought about this mass killing. The first challenge was the national question. So in our discussions today, it's been very clear that our nationality, our national loyalty, the nation which we choose to belong to be loyal to, is a part of a set of other identities. A number of the people who have been evoked today, including Archbishop Sheptytsky, are very good examples of how our loyalty to a nation is one that we choose among other loyalties. The nation is also a political problem. The way that the Soviet Union addressed this political problem in the beginning was to bring its territories into what it called national republics. Now, this is very important for us to know because the events that we're describing today took place at a time when there was a great deal of starvation in the Soviet Union in general, in other places too, in Kazakhstan first, in southern Russia as well. But there was a specificity, there was a particular character to the events that took place inside Soviet Ukraine. So we must know that the Soviet Union had an approach to the national question, and that was to divide its territory up into these national units. Perhaps more important from the Soviet point of view was the peasant question. So the idea of a Marxist revolution was to serve the working class. In the Soviet Union as it was created in the early 1920s, there wasn't very much of a working class. So the basic question which faced Lenin and then his successor Stalin was, how do we create a working class? How do we shift from having had a political revolution in 1917 to an economic and social revolution in which a working class will be created? So what was being contemplated was the dramatic and rapid and violent transformation of a country where there were far more nomads than workers and far more peasants than anyone else into a country which was a working class country. So this was a project of transformation. The particular events, the particular tragedy of Ukraine in 1932 and 1933 is a part of the Soviet attempt to, as they would see it and as they described it, to resolve the peasant question, or as they would say, to resolve the kulak question, kulak being a Russian word for a prosperous peasant. In the 1920s, after the suffering of the revolution, after the suffering of the Russian Civil War, these questions were put on hold for a little while. I mention the early 1920s also for a reason, which is that in 1921 and 1922, in eastern Ukraine and in southern Russia, there was also a desperate famine in which millions of people died. It's worth keeping that in mind because that famine of 1921 and 1922 was broadly known. It was not a surprise. Delegates from many other nations were allowed to visit. The United States, as well as other countries and several organizations, organized massive relief of that famine in 1921 and 1922. I mention that only because that's normal. It's normal when there is a tragedy for people to be allowed to help. This is a striking difference with what happens in 1932 and 1933. In 1932 and 1933, millions of people will be dying, but an abnormal thing will happen, which is that no one from outside will be allowed to help. Beyond that, anyone from outside who tries simply to describe the event that was taking place will be condemned as a fascist or worse. That is an abnormal situation. So I mention this terrible famine of 1921 and 1922 to create a contrast. I also mention it because 1921 and 1922, for some people, such as Joseph Stalin, was a lesson. The lesson is that hunger is part of politics. Giving food and taking it away is a normal, as he sees it, part of politics. This is the kind of thing which simply happens in the world. This brings us to the late 1920s, when Joseph Stalin comes to power. The Soviet system, as some of you will know very well, but I will take some time anyway with it, the Soviet system is a system which works according to the following logic. In principle, this is a system which is meant to serve the working class. The working class in the system is represented by the Communist Party. The Communist Party is represented by a Central Committee. The Central Committee in turn by a Politburo, and the Politburo by the strongest personality on it. In the late 1920s, the strongest personality that asserted itself was that of Joseph Stalin. He asserted himself with a policy of collectivization. Now, collectivization may seem like a long, abstract word, but within that notion of collectivization, these awkward Russian communist words, collectivization, de-kulakization, hides a transformation of society and hides the aspiration to change what human life is like. What collectivization meant is that those who controlled land, farmers, people in places like Ukraine, who in the last couple of generations had managed to get control of a bit of private property for themselves, that all of these people would lose their land. Now, for those of you who are in cities and live in apartments, this may not strike you immediately as dramatic, but this was a time still in the history of the world where most people lived on land. And in a place like Ukraine, which several people have mentioned already, the breadbasket of Europe, this was a place where most people still lived on the land, lived themselves and provided for others from the land. So the project of taking people by force away from the land and into a different kind of life is already dramatic enough. The idea that peasants should be treated as an enemy in a class war, which is Stalin's idea in 1928 and 1929, is already very dramatic. The idea that we will take all of the peasants who we believe are most successful and deprive them of their land is already a radical change. And this was a change that took place at the same time as the creation of the Gulag. So Gulag is another word from Soviet history that we should remember. The emergence of the Gulag, the large system of prison and concentration camps in Kazakhstan, in northern Russia, this system is created in the late 1920s. And the first large groups of people who are sent to the Gulag are precisely peasants. About 300,000 peasants from Soviet Ukraine are sent to the Gulag in 1928, 1929, and 1930. This creates a situation for them in which they have two very bad choices, and choice might be too strong of a word. If you are seen to be prosperous, or if you are seen to be resisting the collective farm, then you will be sent to the Gulag. But if you stay in Ukraine, you will lose your farm, you'll be assigned to a collective farm, you'll be governed instead of by yourself, you'll be governed by the local officials at a machine tractor station, and that will be your life. I take it that this system, as I describe it in this abstract way, seems decisively tragic enough. But what we now have to ask is, what happens to the food supply as the system is put into practice? So in 1930, in the first weeks of 1930, most of Ukraine, most of Soviet Ukraine, is collectivized. It's collectivized in a terrifyingly quick way. It's collectivized by force. Tens of thousands of Ukrainians run across the border to Romania or usually to Poland. There's massive resistance to collectivization. The Soviet secret police records 1 million acts of resistance to collectivization in early 1930. And so Stalin pulls back. He gives a famous speech, which is called Dizzy with Success, in which he says, this has been going too well. We should slow down. In 1931, collectivization then moves forward, but by a clever, more indirect way. It moves forward by extreme taxation. If you don't join the collective farm, your farm is taxed so much that you can't keep it up. It's created by seizures of the seed grain. In other words, if you don't join the collective farm, I will take the seed that you need to plant your crop next year. And so the second time in 1931, collectivization actually takes place. The expectation was that the collective farm would work as well as private agriculture. So the Soviet state set a target for how much grain they would take from peasants, which was based on the very good harvest of 1930. In 1931, the harvest was much poorer, a bit because the weather was bad, but mostly because the chaos of collectivization itself had meant that farming simply wasn't as productive. And it's in late 1931 that the starvation begins. By June of 1932, Stalin himself uses the word golod. Stalin himself acknowledges that there is famine in Soviet Ukraine. The important thing then is what happens next. Famine in the Soviet Union as a result of collectivization was fairly common. By June of 1932, around 1.5 million people in Kazakhstan had already starved to death as a result of collectivization. People in southern Russia were also starving at that moment as a result of collectivization. The thing that was specific about Ukraine was that Stalin defined what happened in Ukraine as political. He said, this is the result of Ukrainian nationalists, Ukrainian provocateurs. This proves that Ukrainians in particular are disloyal, and Ukrainians in particular are deserving of punishment. this one of the statements that Cardinal Innitzer made in his declaration of October 1933 was very true. He said, millions of people in Ukraine died, and they need not have died. That is correct. Had decisions been taken differently in autumn of 1932, a few hundred thousand Ukrainians would have died instead of about 4 million. So what happens in 1932 is that Soviet policy takes a specific and unmistakably murderous turn against the Republic of Soviet Ukraine. Let me mention a few of these policies. One of them is that the border between Soviet Ukraine and the rest of the world was fortified. That had already happened. It's going to be very difficult to escape to Poland or to Romania. The second is that the borders between Soviet Ukraine and the rest of the Soviet Union were sealed. So if you were inside Soviet Ukraine, you could not flee to Soviet Belarus or Soviet Russia. A third is that the peasants were forced to stay in the villages. People were denied the papers they would need to go and beg in the city. So the horrible, the almost unimaginably horrible thing about these photos that you have just seen is that those were the good places. Those were the cities. That was Kharkiv. The people that you saw dying were the very small percentage of peasants from the countryside who were able to make it to a city and beg and then died on the streets of the city. Or, by the way, more often died in dark basements where they were locked up by the city police, places that were called the hunger barracks. What you're seeing is a small part of a small part of a small part. The huge majority of death was precisely in the countryside. Another measure that was taken specifically against Ukrainian people living in Soviet Ukraine in the countryside was to take away the meat ration. Again, that sounds very abstract. The meat ration is the goat that you had that was still alive, or the cow that you had that was still alive. If you live in the countryside on a farm, that last goat or that last cow is your last way of surviving. It's the thing you keep alive for the last moment. That was taken away. Another measure which was taken was called the black list. If your collective farm failed to supply enough grain, and in these conditions this was almost impossible, you were then locked out of the rest of the Soviet economy and not allowed to trade with the Soviet economy at all. So by way of these specific measures and by way of forced requisitions, that is, by way of so-called brigades coming from cities, brigades coming from elsewhere to come and forcibly take whatever was food, a situation in which hundreds of thousands of people would have died became a situation in which millions of people died by early 1933. So it's hard to know how to characterize this event, but I want to mention a couple of things that I will develop a bit later. One has already been suggested, very generously, by Ambassador Shcherba, which is that this isn't just mass killing, it's also mass observation of and mass participation in the dying of your students or your family or your neighbors. This is not a kind of dying which took place quickly and privately. This is a kind of dying which took place massively and publicly, and where the calories in human bodies were something that every other human had to think about. This is a kind of dying which forced everyone to make horrifying choices. In a time in European history where there were many horrifying choices, surely these were among the most horrifying choices. And in this way and others, this was a kind of killing which also destroyed a way of life. It destroyed what remained of village solidarity, family solidarity, solidarity within marriages, friendships, whatever kind of solidarity remained was destroyed here. And in this sense, this was also perhaps the purest and most radical expression of Soviet policy. It's for these reasons, by the way, that Raphael Lemkin, a Holocaust survivor who invented the word genocide, spoke of the Holodomor as a typical Soviet genocide. Not only because it killed people, but because it made a way of living impossible. The second thing which is striking about this particular event is that it was the first truly big lie in the politics of the 20th century. Other big lies will follow. The lie, Hitler's lie, of the Jewish international conspiracy is about to become very important. But this was a very big lie. The lie that Stalin told and that the Soviet leadership told that nothing of this kind was happening. The total denial of an event of this scale was new and is terrifying in a particular way. It adds a level, I think, to the horror to say not only did this happen, but from the very beginning, all of the individual experiences of the kind that Ambassador Streba mentioned, all of these individual human experiences were denied. But it's not just that they were denied, it's that they were characterized as lies. And it's worse than that. They were characterized as political provocations. The official line in Soviet Ukraine among communists was that the starving are provocateurs, that their bloated bellies are deliberate provocations against the Soviet regime, and that is how they are to be understood. So, I have told you what historians know now. Other historians would no doubt tell the story in a slightly different way. That is the way history works. But what I've tried to do is give you what I think is a rough consensus of the history of Soviet Ukraine in 1932 and 1933. I'm telling you some things that people wouldn't have understood at the time. What I'd like to do now is give you a sense of what people did know at the time, or who knew what. The first group of people who knew what happened were the diplomats. Even the Austrian diplomats, who were few and had relatively meager resources, knew about the famine in Ukraine. If you read their reports, which were written directly to Dollfuss, you see accurate, detailed accounts of villages. You see an estimate of total deaths, which is fairly close to the mark. But there were other diplomats who knew much more, the Italians, the Germans, and probably above all the Poles. So the Poles had a big embassy in Kharkiv, again, the city that you were just looking at. They had consulates throughout Soviet Ukraine. They had lots and lots of local informers, and they did a lot of traveling around the Republic, which means that in their reports from spring 1932 to spring 1933, you have dozens of very long accounts, very long and detailed accounts of the starvation in Soviet Ukraine. Now, that is very useful now if you want to know what happened in Soviet Ukraine. The Polish diplomats had no reason to change the story one way or another. But what, and I say this now respectfully, what diplomats know, in fact, every diplomat already knows this, what diplomats know does not necessarily translate into policy. In July of 1932, Poland had signed a non-aggression treaty with the Soviet Union. One of the consequences of this non-aggression treaty was that the Polish press did not write about mass starvation in the Soviet Union. So diplomats knew, but the fact that diplomats knew didn't mean that the world knew. Who else knew? Some journalists knew, but most of the journalists, not all, and I'll return to this, most of the journalists were forced to remain in Moscow, and most of the journalists did not report on what they knew. They gossiped about it to one another, they occasionally let a few things slip to outsiders, but most of them chose not to write simple stories about what was happening in Ukraine in order not to lose the ability to stay in Moscow and write about other things. So the fact that the journalists knew also didn't count for very much. Who were the sources then? The sources of what was really happening in the world were the refugees. The refugees were the sources. People knew in Europe what was happening in Soviet Ukraine because of the refugees from Soviet Ukraine. These came in a flood in early 1930. Then the Soviets succeeded in fortifying the border so that there were few of them. But in May of 1933, a fairly large group of refugees from Soviet Ukraine managed to cross the Polish border into Poland, into what we call Galicia. In Galicia, as every Ukrainian will know, but I'll just explain this anyway, in Galicia, there lived a very large group of Ukrainians. Galicia is the territory that had belonged to the Habsburg monarchy, was added to Poland. So most Ukrainians in the world at that time lived either in Soviet Ukraine or they lived just west of that in Galicia or Volhynia. They lived in Poland. So refugees from Hunger made it across the border to Poland. This meant that a number of people in Poland, Ukrainians in Poland, knew what was happening. Until that time, there had been a certain amount of doubt because without human witnesses, it's hard to know. But as of May 1933, there were sufficient records that Metropolitan Andrei Sheptytsky, for one, could issue an appeal, as has already been mentioned. But beyond that, other Ukrainian political activists began to travel around Europe on the basis of what they knew to try to explain to Europeans and others the scale of this disaster. So, and this for me is very important because it's a story of people who knew the truth on the basis of what they had been told by refugees and how that was stopped, with one exception. And the one exception is the one we're talking about today. Ukrainians from Galicia were a very well-organized and effective group in general. In the summer and fall of 1933, a number of them, and I'll mention in particular Milena Rudnitska, who was probably the most important, a number of them went from capital to capital, from conference to conference, from reporter to reporter, trying to explain the significance of this story. In September of 1933, several of them, and again the most important was Milena Rudnitska, succeeded in Geneva in getting an international women's organization to recognize the Holodomor, which meant that there was actually an appeal issued to all civilized women in the world to boycott Soviet goods. They succeeded in getting the League of National the Congress of National Minorities to discuss the famine in Ukraine. And thanks to that, they succeeded, these Ukrainians, in getting an audience at the League of Nations in the end of September 1933. This is a very significant achievement, after all. The League of Nations is the heart of international governments, such as it was in 1933. However, the Soviet Union was not a member. So what these Ukrainians managed to do was to get the League of Nations to meet, but in secret, and to pass a resolution, but quietly, to the effect that there was a famine in Ukraine and that the world ought to help. In practice, all this meant was communication with the Red Cross, and the Red Cross could not enter Soviet Ukraine because Soviet authorities did not allow it to do so. Which brings us to the exceptional actions that we are discussing today. Against this context of what was known and how hard it was to say it, the actions of Archbishop Initzer stand out all the more. Because the problem wasn't just that you needed first-person accounts. You needed a few witnesses. The problem was also that the Soviet Union very powerfully denied what was happening. And denied is too weak a word for it. If you said something in public about this, you could count on being attacked in vicious, vicious ways. The people who did so were attacked. And now I want to mention the exceptional journalists. There were two. There was a man called Malcolm Muggeridge, who wrote for The Guardian, who wrote several stories in March of 1933 about famine in Ukraine, not under his own name. There was one journalist who wrote about the famine in Ukraine on the basis of firsthand observation and under his own name. One. That man was Gareth Jones from Wales. In late 1933, he published a series of articles based upon firsthand observation very close to the pictures that you just saw, and had them published in the Western press. This made a great deal of difference. Just one made a great deal of difference. But he was, of course, attacked by his fellow journalists. He was attacked by the Soviet Union. And in 1935, he was murdered. So in this climate that here in Vienna, a clear statement was made, it's all the more extraordinary. The difficulties were, the general difficulties were mentioned by the learned rabbi. This is depression. It's a time of depression. It's a time of national enmity. It's a time of political extremism. Those are also difficulties. Against this atmosphere, we see the three things that Cardinal Innocer did as being all the more extraordinary. The first is the appeal of 20 August 1930, an appeal which he can make because of what he knows from Andrei Sheptytsky and from Greek Catholics. The second is the first meeting, the first ecumenical interconfessional meeting in Vienna in October of 1933, which includes the Roman Catholics, the Greek Catholics, Armenian Catholics, the Orthodox, the Protestants, as well as the Jewish community. And here I want to mention something very special, or something which I think is very important, since we're speaking of witnesses, and I think it ought not to be overlooked. The reason why the Jüdische Gemeinde was so important in 1933 was that in 1933, Ukraine was one of the most important Jewish countries in the world. In 1933, Ukraine and Poland are the heart of where Jews actually live in the world. So it was important but also understandable that Jews in Vienna had already formed their own committee to help people who were starving in the Soviet Union, and that they joined this initiative of Cardinal Innitzer. But the point that I want to make about witnessing is this. The Holocaust is a distinct crime, and one which I can't describe the distinctiveness of here, but the people who survived the Holocaust very often had the human generosity to remember other things. So if one spends time with the testimonies of Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, one notices that Jewish survivors of the Holocaust from Ukraine very often mention the Holodomor. In other words, if we had no other sources today on the Holodomor, we would still know about it because Jewish survivors of the Holocaust who were asked in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s to talk about the Holocaust, and who were asked by people who knew nothing about Ukraine, nothing about the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, they remembered the Holodomor. And why did they remember the Holodomor? Because it happened in the place where they lived. How could you not remember it? But I mention this because it's characteristic of how we remember so often that we leave others out. But the people who truly remember have to be remembering the others. If it's actually a memory, then it must include the others. So the third thing that Cardinal Innitzer did was to bring together an international conference on the 16th and 17th of December 1933, which included the religious communities of Vienna, as well as a number of international guests from a number of organizations, including Russian organizations. One of the people who spoke at that conference was precisely Milena Rudnitska, this Ukrainian political activist who had probably done more than anyone else in the secular world to bring attention to the tragedy. Now, let me try to summarize the special characteristics of these appeals and these conferences. The first has already been stressed and mentioned, that these were multi-confessional and multinational in two ways. They were multi-confessional and multinational in structure, but they were also multinational and multi-confessional in their description of the victims. Because the victims of famine were, of course, everyone who lived in Soviet Ukraine. That means mostly Ukrainians, but it also means, as has already been mentioned, Poles, Germans, Russians, others who lived in Ukraine. And that it's very interesting to see that that is the description which is offered by Cardinal Innitzer at the time. The second thing which is special, as the Archbishop mentioned, is that these appeals were made on the principle of universal human rights, interestingly, and also on the universal principle of Nächstenliebe, of loving thy neighbor. That's it comes from Leviticus, of course, but it's the most universal of the proclamations that one has in our monotheistic religions. It comes from Leviticus. For Christians, it's most known from the parable of the Good Samaritan, where Nächstenliebe, so, you know, wer ist deine Nächste, right? Who is your neighbor? Your neighbor is he who is suffering, or you're a neighbor if you behave with mercy. So that word Nächstenliebe was very often invoked, and that was unusual and extraordinary. The third thing which was important about these appeals and conferences were that they were open. That is, it seems clear that the people who were organizing them knew that it would be difficult to actually get practical help, food relief, across the Soviet border. So what they did again and again was to say, everyone should know about this, which is important in and of itself in this climate where speaking was so difficult. And then the final thing, which is worth stressing, and this is something which previous speakers have been too modest to stress, Cardinal Initzer wasn't the only person to speak about famine in Ukraine. He was the only person of European stature to do so. The only person of European stature. So his stature meant that he was taking particular risks, but his stature means also that when we look back, his is the only case that we can remember of a European who had a certain kind of profile who was willing to take this particular stance. Please be patient with me for a moment longer while I try to summarize why I think this is significant today. The first is the affirmation of truth. The affirmation of truth. Simply affirming what could be known on the basis of human witness. Having the courage to speak the simple truth as it came from witnesses against and within this cloud of denial and denunciation. That seems to me in that time and in our time and in all times something which is worth remembering, the simple principle of the affirmation of truth. And if it seems easy, think of how rare it was in 1933, or for that matter, think of how rare it is in 2019. And contrast the simple statements, the modest, humble statements that were made by the cardinal and his colleagues in December 1933, with the 17th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which took place a month later, when these very same events are treated as proof of the genius of Comrade Stalin, as proof of the superiority of the Soviet system, as the beginning of a huge lie. And ask yourself which has survived better, the huge lie or the simple truth, right? The truth doesn't survive on its own. The truth needs people to speak it. The second thing which I think is enduring about all of this is the affirmation of precisely universal values. It's interesting that Cardinal Initzer spoke precisely in this way of universal human values. And the universal Christian value, which of course is also a Jewish value and a value which comes from the earliest books of the Bible, is that of Nächstenliebe. The third reason why I think this is worth remembering has to do with Austria and Ukraine, two countries which can seem very far apart. But the Ukrainians who appear in this history, the ones who tried to tell the youth the truth to Europe, they were all Austrian subjects in their youth. Milena Dunitska spent the first 26 years of her life as a subject of the Habsburg monarchy. All of these Galician Ukrainians come from Austria. This was their capital when they were young. And this action from Vienna towards Ukraine is an example of how, as Cardinal Initzer himself put it, Austria could play its traditional role of mediating between East and West. This strikes me as particularly important in an Austria which can sometimes feel itself to be a small country which has no neighbors, or a small country which is somehow very far away from a Ukraine that has conflict, or Ukraine that has refugees, or Ukraine about which many lies are told. The next reason why I think this is worth remembering is as an example of trying to intervene during times of mass killing. We have a history of the Armenian genocide. We have a history of the Holodomor. We have a history of the Holocaust. We don't have a history of people trying to stop these things. That's a very weak history. It is cheering and ennobling to be able to add at least one small example to that history, to the history of people trying, if only trying, to bring it about. But I wonder, though, well, I wonder if Milena Rudnitska was right. In 1958, when she wrote about all of this, when she wrote about Cardinal Initzer, when she wrote about herself and the other Galician Ukrainians, when she wrote about the Campaign of Lies of 1933, she said, "We failed completely to tell the world about the famine." She saw it as a complete failure. I wonder if the failure was as complete as all of that. I wonder if the fact that Cardinal Initzer and others raised their voices in the end of 1933 might perhaps have had some significance. Because after all, famine was never used as a weapon this way in the Soviet Union again. Famine was never used in this way by Soviet authorities. It was used by others, but by Soviet authorities, this was the last time. Historians often wonder why it is that policy changed so categorically between 1933 and 1934. I'm not trying to say that I know the answer. I'm just trying to say that the fact that a prominent European brought some attention to this in late 1933 might just possibly have made a difference. Now, of course, if you're a Ukrainian or if your family's history goes back to Soviet Ukraine, you will think, yes, but millions had already died. And indeed, millions had already died. But afterwards, the policy did change. And isn't it just possible, isn't it just thinkable that the one major European attempt to draw attention to this might have had some difference? Since we have forgotten our subject, since we have forgotten about Cardinal Initzer, since we've forgotten about this appeal, I think the question as we remember this appeal is at least worth asking. The very final point that I want to make has to do with individuals. So when we tell the story of, when Christians tell the story of the Good Samaritan about Nächstenliebe, there's only one victim, right? The victim is the Jew who's in a ditch, who's rescued by the Samaritan, the member of a different people, just one person. When we try to remember a tremendous, horrifyingly huge tragedy like the Holodomor, a challenge is to remember all of these millions as one person at a time. And for this, the photographs do help a bit, that we can't remember a million, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million. We can't do it. But we can try to think of one person over and over and over again. When we try to remember the scale of these events, the kinds of recollections that Ambassador Serba was courageous enough to share with us are so very important, because we can think, yes, it was like this for that 12-year-old girl, and it was something like that for millions of other people at the same time. But what I want to close with is the importance that single individuals can make during times which seem to be precisely unchangeable. I've mentioned Milena Rudnitska. There were other Ukrainians who tried to draw attention to the famine, but she was particularly significant. Had she not been there, I'm not sure that it would have come to the events that we're talking about today. Had she not spent half of 1933 trying to draw every international institution into this problem, I'm not sure that we would have come to this. Gareth Jones, one reporter, one single Western reporter writing in a Western language under his own name, one. And yet the difference between one and zero is so extraordinarily great. And that is, of course, I think, why we honor a person who, you know, hat ein Zeichen gesetzt. That he left a sign doesn't mean that he was a perfect person. None of us is. It means that he was the only person of his stature, the only person of his stature to have done something like this in the Europe of his time, and that one is ever so much greater than zero. Thank you.